Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 4, which I'm going to call Eliphaz Speaks, The Innocent Prosper, Part 1, because Eliphaz is a winded son of a gun. He's going to take two chapters to make one point, which is that the innocent prosper. Job, you ain't prospering, so Job, you ain't innocent. Our context is this. In our last chapter, chapter 3, Job lamented the day he was born in very poetic, eloquent language. He's already lost, of course, all of his property and all of his sons and daughters. So we go now to Job 4, verses 1 and 2. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered, "If one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking?" The "then" there refers to the period after the 7 days of silence. Remember, the three friends of Job came to comfort him, and so they were so shocked by his appearance, they sat down next to him and didn't say a word for 7 days. And some people speculate 7 days implies a 7-day fast. But anyway, they were all there surrounding him, watching him in his misery, but not saying a word. And finally, Eliphaz says, "If one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking?" Now, let's talk about Eliphaz a little bit. He's from Teman, which is that town that's noted for wisdom south of the Dead Sea in Edom. Eliphaz was the only one of the three false friends that God had spoken directly to, that God will speak directly to. We read that in Job 42, verse 7. "It came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has.'" Ooh, little rebuke there. This idea that if you're sick, you must be sinning. If you've had calamity, you must be a sinner. Now, this is what John Gill says about Eliphaz, quite eloquently. "Eliphaz said not anything by way of condolence or consolation, not pitying Job's case, nor comforting him in his afflicted circumstances, as they required both, but reproaching him as a wicked and hypocritical man, not acting like himself formally or according to his profession and principles, but just the reverse. This was a new trial to Job, and some think the sorest of all. It was as a sword in his bones, which was very cutting to him, as oil cast into a fiery furnace in which he now was, which increased the force and fury of it, and as to vinegar, an opened and bleeding wound, which makes it smart the more." In other words, Eliphaz ain't helping out any. He's making Job feel more miserable than he already is, as we'll see in this chapter. Now, this doesn't mean that Eliphaz was speaking out of malice towards Job. He was one of Job's friends, but he was speaking stupidly, and to ameliorate some of his blame, he was speaking according to the knowledge of the time, which didn't understand that sometimes bad things happen to good people. But nonetheless, he's rebuked by God directly. And as Jameson Fawcett Brown says, Eliphaz was the mildest of Job's accusers. Wait till the other two get in on Job. It just gets worse and worse in great dramatic fashion. Eliphaz is apparently the spokesman. God speaks to him and says, "I'm mad at you and your two friends." Perhaps Eliphaz worked out a scheme with the other two friends as to who was to say what and in what order, as John Gill suggests. The first thing that Eliphaz says, "Will you become impatient?" Now, what does that mean? He's probably saying, "Look, you're already pretty burdened down. Can you stand some more from us? And I know it's a tough thing for us to pile this on you, but who can refrain from speaking? We can't help but speak to you. We got to say something to you, buddy." Now, Eliphaz being very polite here, this reflects the great status and honor that Job held in his community. He was a great man. Eliphaz just doesn't barge in without permission, but he can't refrain from speaking, he says, because he feels that he must speak to protect God's honor. God's honor is being besmirched because Job said he hadn't sinned. He hadn't sinned, therefore bad things have happened, therefore God must be a bad God. That's kind of the way that Eliphaz is thinking. It made God look bad that he should allow such suffering to fall on an innocent man. We go now to Job 4, verses 3 through 4. Eliphaz continues speaking to Job. "Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees." And now Eliphaz is going to point out to Job what a great man he was. Used to be, I should say. "Job has admonished many," he says. Job's godly lifestyle had been an example to many. He was respected as an influential leader. He helped those in need. He saw that justice was done. He strengthened weak hands. Well, let's look at some scriptures showing what Job had done. Job 29, 7 through 17. This is Job speaking. When I went out to the gate of the city, when I took my seat in the square, the young men saw me and hid themselves. And the old men arose and stood. The young men didn't even want to stand in the presence of such a mighty man. Verse 9, Job 29. The princes stopped talking and put their hands on their mouths. The voices of the nobles was hushed, and their tongues stuck to their palate. For when the ear heard, it called me blessed. And when the eye saw, it gave witness of me, because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me, and I made the widow's heart sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I investigated the case which I did not know. I broke the jaws of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth. In other words, Job is saying, hey, I didn't do anything to deserve this. We read in Job 31, verses 13 through 22. Job speaking again. If I have despised the claim of my male or female slaves when they filed a complaint against me, what then could I do when God arises? And when he calls me to account, what will I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him, and the same one fashion us in the womb? If I have kept the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the orphan has not shared it? But from my youth he grew up with me as with a father, and from infancy I guided her. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or that the needy had no covering, if his loins have not thanked me, and if he has not been warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the orphan because I saw I had support in the gate, let my shoulder fall from the socket and my arm be broken off at the elbow. Well, that's a long way of saying, I've taken care of my slaves, the poor, the widows, the orphans, and if I haven't, let my arm be broken off. I didn't do anything to deserve all this, Job is later on saying in these later chapters. Well, now Eliphaz has got to be confronted with this. He knows that Job's been a righteous man. He says so right here in verse 3. So now he's got to figure out, well, if he's so righteous, why is Job so miserable right now? We go now to Job chapter 4, verses 5 through 6. Eliphaz continues speaking to Job. But now that this has happened to you, you have become exhausted. It strikes you, and you are dismayed. Isn't your piety, your confidence, and the integrity of your life your hope? Now, what is Eliphaz saying here? Here's a couple of options. He could be saying Job was never righteous to start with, because piety is your confidence. Well, you don't have any confidence now, and piety, or your integrity, your belief in God, is your hope. Well, you don't have any hope now. So therefore, you must have no more piety, no more fear of God, no more integrity, no more belief in God. Well, now Eliphaz could be saying Job never was righteous to start with. Well, if he does say that, he's got a problem with all that stuff I just read you about all the wonderful stuff Job had done. Perhaps Eliphaz is implying that Job was outwardly righteous when he says all those wonderful things, when he talks about all those wonderful works he had done, but it was hypocritical righteousness. In other words, Eliphaz could be implying that Job only was outwardly righteous, only because of the good things God gave him. I don't believe that. It's obvious Job was a righteous man, and I believe Eliphaz is not stupid enough to believe that Job was a hypocrite. Option number two, well, sure, your piety is your confidence, and the integrity of your life is your hope. Sure, but that was before. Now, you're suffering so bad, so that means you must have done something unrighteous somewhere. And the unrighteous thing you've done is you maintain your innocence. In other words, you have done something to offend God, and now you're doubling down on your offense by maintaining your innocence, which is a lie. And that's probably what Eliphaz is saying. There's something wrong here, Job. Eliphaz is probably, or possibly also saying, look, you told others to fear God. You used yourself as an example. And you expect others to have confidence and hope looking at you now? As Adam Clark says. We go now to Job 4, verses 7 through 11. Consider, Eliphaz continued speaking to Job, who has perished when he was innocent? Where have the honest been destroyed? In my experience, those who plow injustice and those who sow trouble reap the same. They perish at a single blast from God and come to an end by the breath of his nostrils. The lion may roar and the fierce lion growl, but the fangs of young lions are broken. The strong lion dies if it catches no prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. Verse 7 says this, Eliphaz says this, consider who has perished when he was innocent. Of course, its implication is it's a rhetorical question. He was saying, no innocent man ever perished, because innocent people don't die because bad things don't happen to good people. Well, Jesus gives an example of innocent people perishing in Luke 13, 1 through 3. Now, on the same occasion, there were some present who reported to him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And what Jesus meant by that is some Galileans had come down to Jerusalem to sacrifice in the temple, and Pilate butchered them. And so their bloody sacrifices had their own human blood mixed with the animal blood, which is kind of a poetic way of saying it. Their blood was mixed with their sacrifices. And Jesus said to them, do you suppose that these Galileans were greater sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered this fate? And of course, that's a rhetorical question. The answer is no, they're not any greater sinners. They didn't sin any more than anybody else to deserve this horrible tragedy. I mean, tragedy happens. Bad things happen to good people, and Jesus pointed it out. Well, Jesus was blasting the Pharisees' idea. They apparently had the same idea as Job's false friends. If you're good and righteous, good things will happen to you all the time, and if you're bad, bad things will happen to you. Well, of course, what Eliphaz is doing here, who has perished when he was innocent, he's just basically directly telling Job, you're not innocent because you are perishing. This actually was the common view of the time, according to the NIV Study Bible, commenting in the next chapter, chapter 5, verse 27. The common view was that bad things never happen to good people. Now, in verse 8, Eliphaz appeals to his experience. In my experience, those who plow injustice and those who sow trouble reap the same. Well, now, that's not too far off. On the surface, Eliphaz has experience and scriptures on his side. Let's look at some scripture here. Proverbs 22:8. He who sows iniquity will reap vanity, and the rod of his fury will perish. That sounds like you do bad, bad things happen to you. Galatians 6:7-8. Paul says this, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. So in other words, you sow to your flesh, which means you sin, and you're going to reap corruption. But if you sow to the Spirit, you plant seeds of the Holy Spirit, if you will, fruit will come. Good things happen to good people. But you got to balance that verse with the case of Job. Not every corrupt thing opposed to eternal life comes from one's flesh. Sometimes bad things happen because it's a trial for good people. Let's look at Matthew 7:16-18. Matthew 7:16-18. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. There you go. Bad tree, bad fruit. Bad people do bad things. Job, you have had bad things happen to you, therefore you must have done bad. You bore bad fruit, your sickness and calamities. Hosea 8:7, for they sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads, it yields no grain. Sowing the wind means you're doing something stupid. You don't sow wind, you sow ground. You put your seed in the ground, not in the sky where the wind can carry it away. So you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. Bad things happen to you. Hosea 10:13, you have plowed wickedness. You have reaped injustice. You have eaten the fruit of lies. Because you have trusted in your way and your numerous warriors, bad things happen. I didn't get the rest of the quote here. Verse 14 of Hosea 10, the roar of battle will rise against your people, and all your fortifications will be demolished. Mothers will be dashed to pieces along with their children. Oh, bad things happen to bad people. Well, sure, in general, Eliphaz's experience is true. That happens a lot of times. You do bad stuff, you end up in prison, but not always. Some people prosper and make a bunch of money. Look at Jeffrey Epstein. He was doing fine for a long time. Of course, he ended up dead in a prison cell. But a lot of times, the wicked prosper and good people suffer, like Job was doing. So, how can we summarize all this? Oftentimes, bad things do happen to people because of their sin, but not always. Now, Eliphaz continues in verse 9 to show that bad things happen to people like Job. They perish at a single blast from God, referring to those who plow injustice. A blast from God from his nostrils. He just kind of sniffs, a reverse sniff. He kind of blows out of his nostrils one time. Bam! It's like a hurricane coming out of his nostrils and destroying people in its way. Then he goes to a lion metaphor in verse 10. The lion may roar. This is talking about a bad, powerful sinner like Job. The lion may roar and the fierce lion growl, but the fangs of young lions are broken. In other words, you might be strong, Job. You might think you're strong, but you're weak compared to God. And your fangs, your mouth is going to be smashed. And that's going to happen to you if you think you're going to fight against God and not admit to him that you sinned. We go now to Job chapter 4, verses 12 through 17. Now a word was brought to me stealthily, and my ear received a whisper of it, amid disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night. When deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me and trembling. This is Eliphaz still speaking to Job. Dread came upon me and trembling, and made all my bones shake. Then a spirit passed by my face. The hair of my flesh bristled up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. Then I heard a voice. Can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? Now this word, it says in verse 12, that came to Eliphaz, what was it? Here's some options. Could have been a made-up lie by Eliphaz. Well, there's some arguments against that. First of all, Eliphaz was screwed up. He was wrong. But he wasn't a bad man. He was Job's friend. Job actually sacrificed for him at the end of the book at God's command. Some people try to show that Eliphaz was a good man because one of his words was quoted by the Apostle Paul, which is kind of interesting. In the next chapter, Job 5:13, Eliphaz says, he captures the wise by their own shrewdness, talking about God does that, and the advice of the cunning is quickly thwarted. Paul quotes that in 1 Corinthians 3:19, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God, for it is written, he is the one who catches the wise in their craftiness. A direct quote of Eliphaz. But that doesn't really prove anything. Paul quoted pagan Greek poets. That doesn't mean that the pagan Greek poets were justified in their paganism. But I think we can say that Eliphaz didn't make this up. So what was it? Well, John Gill suggests that it was a vision from God, but as Gill concedes, if it was from God, Eliphaz nevertheless misused the vision by misapplying it to Job. I just have trouble believing that Eliphaz is such a prophet that he can have a vision like that, especially at this time, because it would obviously be applied to Job. So I have trouble believing that God would take that particular time to give Eliphaz a prophecy. I don't know why he would do that. And if it was just a general word, can mankind be just before God? Well, that's not very profound. That's a truism. Everybody knows that. Nobody can be pure before God. So I don't think it was from God. Was it from the devil? Could be. I don't see why not. John Gill doesn't think so, but I think it could be from the devil. The NIV Study Bible has another option that Eliphaz is merely speaking figuratively, not literally. After all, this is poetry, and he could just be talking, using a dream, a hypothetical dream as a literary device, and it is quite effective if you read it. It's almost spooky. A literary device to talk about how he had a word from God. Now, this word that was brought to Eliphaz came stealthily, as the NASB puts it. NIV has secretly. In my ear received a whisper of it. Oh, this is some secret knowledge. That gets close to Gnosticism when you start talking about secret knowledge. So I don't know what I think about this vision of Eliphaz. He could have just had a dream. I didn't even think about that as another option. This could be a dream. But anyway, it was a nightmare because dread came upon him and trembling came upon him and all his bones started shaking. All of that for the spirit to stop and tell him, you can't be just before God. I mean, really, does that make a lot of sense? It's a truism. I could have gone in there and told Eliphaz that. Verse 15, this spirit that passed by his face. Here's some options that have been suggested. Wind. An angel. How about a demon? Might as well put that in there too. Whatever it was made the hair of his flesh, his beard, bristle. He was scared out of his mind. Scared? Why? Because the spirit's got to tell him. In fact, the spirit stood still there for dramatic effect, waiting until he got Eliphaz's attention. Eliphaz looks at the form. He can't discern what it is. He just knows it's standing still. But Eliphaz's attention is fixed toward that spirit, And then there was silence, more pause, more dramatic effect. Then he hears this voice. I mean, the whole thing is just built up as some real big deal. All right, so let's deal with this problem of how can such a dramatic vision eventuate into a prophecy that mankind is not good? That's a truism. Why would an angel or God or anybody, why would a dream tell Eliphaz such a commonplace thing? Even sinners know that's true, that sinners aren't equal to God. Well, I think the answer, and this is my answer, I didn't get this anywhere, I believe that Eliphaz is applying what he either made up or saw or dreamed. He is applying that specifically to Job's situation. Job is not claiming to be absolutely righteous, and so Eliphaz is not trying to tell him that you can't be absolutely righteous. That's obvious. For Eliphaz to relate an angelic vision telling Job that he is not absolutely righteous and perfect like God, well, that's so what? That's a truism. But Job is rather claiming to be relatively righteous. In other words, I haven't sinned enough on this earth to justify this kind of suffering. And so Eliphaz is trembling now because he's saying, oh, wait a minute now. You're saying that against God? You're accusing God of injustice? That is a serious thing. That justifies trembling and my bones shaking. And he's saying that that spirit that came to him in his night dream, that spirit told him, no, Job, you cannot be relatively righteous. Didn't mention Job by name, but that's who he is probably referring to. Can mankind be just before God? In other words, the spirit in verse 17 tells Eliphaz, hey, can Job be just before God? There's trouble brewing here, Eliphaz. We got somebody that's shaking his fist before God. We go now to Job chapter 4, verses 18 through 21, and we will finish chapter 4. If God puts no trust in his servants, and he charges his angels with foolishness, how much more those who dwell in clay houses, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed like a moth? They are smashed to pieces from dawn to dusk. They perish forever while no one notices. Are their tent cords not pulled up? They die without wisdom. Now, Eliphaz tells us in verse 18 that God charges his angels with foolishness. I'm assuming Eliphaz is correct about that. Here's some options about who these angels are. Those angels could either be unfallen angels or they could be fallen angels. Now, the commentator split on this. The pulpit commentator, Gill and Poole, for example, say that these angels are unfallen angels. And so that when the verse says that God charges his unfallen angels with foolishness, he means comparatively with respect to himself, the angels look foolish, even though they are smarter than us. All creatures look foolish compared to God, and these angels look foolish compared to God. And so basically Eliphaz is saying, look, he uses an a fortiori argument. If God can charge his angels with foolishness, how much more so can he choose ordinary people like you, Job, his servants? How much more can he charge with foolishness those who dwell in clay houses? Now, those clay houses could mean people who live in dirt houses, or it could be referring metaphorically to one's body, a clay house. My spirit is in my clay house, my body. Doesn't matter either way, whose foundation is in the dust. Either my body is founded in the dust of the ground, or my house is. And people who dwell in these clay houses are crushed like a moth. The NIV says, crushed more readily than a moth. Now, verse 20 says that they are smashed to pieces. That's not referring to the moths, of course, but to the people who live in clay houses. They are smashed to pieces from dawn to dusk. As Clark interprets that phrase, in almost every moment of time, some human being comes into the world and someone departs from it. In other words, people are dying all the time. And they perish forever. No one notices. That, of course, is referring to this life. They don't perish forever eternally. They live forever eternally, either evil in the evil place, hell, or the godly place, heaven. Verse 21, are their tent cords not pulled up? Here's some other translations of that. NIV, are not the cords of their tent pulled up? What that means is they die and no longer have a home to live in. Their body is like a tent unmoored from the earth and taken away. KJV has, doth not their excellency go away, which is a lousy translation. I guess if you look at life as something excellent, it's taken away. But basically, what Eliphaz is telling Job is, you're going to die, Job, and you're going to die unknown, and you're going to die without wisdom, he says in verse 21. You're going to be crushed like a moth. You're going to be smashed to pieces. Why? because you won't confess that you're a sinner, that you've got some that you've got a hidden sin somewhere. Ladies and gentlemen, with those nasty words of Eliphaz, we're finished with chapter 4, which prepares us to go to chapter 5, verses 1 through 27, and we will look at Eliphaz continuing to speak and continuing to maintain that the innocent prosper, and that if you're not prospering, you're not innocent. So I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.